Hi, I'm Desi Arnaz Jr. Welcome to Letting Go with Guy Finley. Guy is the best-selling author of Let Go and Live in the Now, and is the founding director of nonprofit Life of Learning Foundation. And now, here's Guy Finley.
There's a very old idea, and the idea is that perfect love casts out fear. But we don't know much about the nature of perfect love. In fact, we know nothing about it. Instead, we've perfected fear, which is quite a reversal of the way things are supposed to be. But it need not, it must not remain that way for you. There is a solution. The unconscious suffering inherent of a life predicated in pretense, which is the root of that fear, is an unnecessary life because another one has been provided for you already. A life that is completely apart from the pain and the punishment, connected with considering only your own ideas about yourself, and then wandering through your relationships trying to apply those ideas as though they were the truth themselves. Freedom is a gift of God. It belongs to no man. It can be granted by no one. It is the activity of spirit in itself. The task of our life on this planet, if we accept it, if we see and are willing to be aware of the ache in always pretending to be something we're not, the fear inherent in it, if we see all that with great clarity, then comes to us as a result of ending an unconscious relationship, a new and bright relationship with what is consciousness itself. Then a person begins to understand what rebirth is. A person begins to know why they were put on this planet. And I'll just say it one more time because I can already see it happening. Even as I'm speaking to you of the most beautiful things that can be spoken of, you're not here to think about yourself. So, I'll tell you a story. Then we're going to do some deep digging. Did you bring your deep digging implements with you? Take a deep breath. You need oxygen to deeply dig. There was once a kingdom. And in this kingdom, there had been a war. There had been a great divide. And as a result of the great divide in this kingdom, the prince, the natural heir to the king, had been lost in the confusion and the melee and the upheaval and the scrambling and the reorganizing and all of the things that took place, and then in the settling that took so long afterwards. He got lost at a very, very young age, so much so that he was not known by the kingdom or the king anymore. Well, I shall say it like this, that he wasn't recognizable. And the reason he wasn't recognizable is the cause of our story, the purpose of it. Because the king at some point, when things were proper and in the right time for the prince to resume his place with his father, sent out word that that the prince himself should return home and claim his crown. And so, as you might imagine, when you're at a party and somebody says, "Who lost this $20 bill?" Hundreds of pretenders showed up. All in a great line. Some dressed to the nines. By the way, what on earth does that mean? Some not. And one by one, they would get up and they would profess for them to the king and to the ministers why it is that they were indeed the missing prince. And when all was said and done, the king and the ministers selected one young man. And the young man they selected, when he got up and received the authority, he had one question that he wanted to ask of the king and the ministers, and that was, how did they know that he was indeed the prince when there were so many others who were claiming to be the prince? And the king looked at him, and the ministers spoke for the king, as they do. And they said, the reason that we knew that all the others were pretenders to the throne was because of how badly each one wanted to be crowned. The reason that we knew that all were pretenders to the throne was because of how badly each one wanted to be crowned. And just like yourself, perhaps the prince didn't quite understand what he meant. And he said, you see, to the prince, you see, the one true prince has his father's blood in him. He is not someone trying to gain anything, because the nature of his own royal nature has already given him everything. The others all saying, I'm the one, bragging, arrogant, talking about themselves and all the reasons why they should be the prince. The real prince didn't need to say anything about himself at all, because he had a prince's nature born of the king. This is a lesson that you can try to impersonate, that you can spend your life cultivating the kingly, the queenly attitude, which you see all the time with these psychopathic spiritual people. Each one mouthing off, spouting consistently all of the things that they know and that they are and why they should be, because this is always at the root of it, why they should be recognized as the one who wears the crown. The one who wears the crown is mostly quiet, because he has nothing to gain. He has nothing to fear. Fear is the principal manifestation of what we will call the me first syndrome. Me first. Under all circumstances, in all conditions, it is me. Now, in case you think this doesn't apply to you, let me clear it up. The me first syndrome is an effect, the expression of an effect in which a person sees and relates to the world only through himself. That's all. Only through himself. Only through herself. The whole universe revolves around that man. That woman. That's the me first syndrome. And please listen, because some of you say, well, that can't be me because I'm this or that or the other. And there are two types that have me first syndrome. There's, we'll call them type A and type B. Type A outwardly express the me first syndrome. They are the ones who insist at all times that the spotlight is on them. And if they're not with others, then they will talk to themselves about themselves in relationship to others. This is type A, me first syndrome. Type B is afraid to talk in front of others, is reluctant to be with anyone, but when they are with others, they will sit and pounce and criticize and judge, because then they're still first. Me first syndrome, a deadly disease of the soul. And this is so important to understand this idea, whose principal premise is rooted in a particular quirk of that sickness, of that illness of the spirit, which can be healed, by the way, And the particular quirk to this, and you must, look, sometimes, I know, I understand, sometimes when the truth cuts too close, you know, you're sitting and you hear it and you go, God, oh, jeez, oh, it's because you know that you're being described to the T. That all you do is think about yourself, worry about yourself, or brag about yourself, talk about your past, talk about what you're going to do. It's just talk, 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 and me is the one who's being talked about. Now listen, the root of that, this is what we have to understand if we're going to be free. And the root of it, what causes this, is that such a man or a woman is always pretending to be first. They're pretending to be first. You see, the fact of the matter is that when you're always trying to prove to yourself that you are yourself, because isn't that, if you look at it, why do I talk about myself? Why do I think about myself all the time? And by the way, what do I do 24 hours a day other than think about myself, talk about myself? Even when I'm thinking about and talking about others, I'm still the center of it. Because there's something in me that needs to continually bring up this earth of myself and patty cake it into some form again. So that I'm always putting me up there and shaping it and shaping it. And when anything knocks off a limb or I got to shape it again. And that's when you'll see anger. Because whenever you see people become angry or frustrated, the form that they have built of themselves, from themselves, has received a blow. And when the blow comes, that nature will, first, depending on the type, they'll either outwardly become aggressive and angry and express that, or they'll retreat inwardly and attack silently in their mind those that they think did that to them, or a combination of both. And here's the root of this, if you'll see it, because we have to see it. We have to see it. I believe I am first. I'm all that matters. And even when I say I love you, it's due to my benevolence. It's due to the way I feel about myself in relationship to you. If I really loved you, I couldn't hurt you. It would be impossible. And the reason it would be impossible is because no man, no woman who understands what is the first presence, what is the true presence, can contradict or compromise their own or anyone else's. And that's what we're going to look at. See, this, and it is, it's the temptation to be first. And it is the great temptation. It is the great temptation to try and put yourself first. Because why? Because you can't succeed. So all you can do is pretend. Look, how many of you have been trying to put yourself first since you had a body? You understand what I'm talking about? The little kids, they don't try to put themselves first until their parents and their nature that works in accordance with their own sleeping parents begins to want to be first. No child thinks about being first. But their nature holds the seed of that, and the parent and the society that we're born in perpetuates that. And the next thing you know, the child wants to be first. Kid wasn't trying to be first. Kid was just living. Now, that means, if you can see it, that over and over again, that I've been trying all my life. Haven't you? I want to be first. I want to be first to get attention. I want to be first to recognize for giving my attention to someone. I want to be first in all instances. And when, because life won't always allow us to be first, I'm not first. I'll put myself first by denigrating those who don't recognize I ought to be first. This is how it works. But here's the hands. Has anybody succeeded yet? Or is it Sisyphus trying to push the rock up the hill over and over again? I'm first. No. And then it rolls back and crushes you. And I'm not first. And then I have to start again and push it up a new career, a new relationship where someone knows that I am what I am. And oh no, and it crushes you again. Over and over trying to be first. And if not out there trying to succeed in the world, in self-degradation, hating yourself, criticizing yourself, tearing yourself apart, because it makes you feel, at least in doing that, you're first in someone's eyes, if only your own. So since I can't be first, which is pretty darn evident, oh, by the way, what's the cause of war on the planet? When you fight with somebody, is it because there are two people who are understanding the truth of the situation, or is it because there's two people, both of whom think to themselves, I'm first, and if you don't see it, there's something wrong with you, and I clobber you? That's war between people and war between countries. I can't succeed at being first, so I have to pretend at it. Because it's all a pretense. If it was real, I wouldn't have to struggle, just like the young prince didn't need to do anything. It was his blood. So if I can't succeed at it, then I do the next best thing. I pretend. But with pretense comes fear. For instance, I'm going to wear the best clothes. When did it become crucial to a human being to be seen as being well-dressed? These are things you never even think to yourself about because you're too busy going out and buying what you believe will allow you to appear as though you've at least reached the upper echelon. You've reached nothing but a nature that's destroying you piece by piece by piece because you don't understand the nature of peace can't be found in the pretense of anything. Greed, gluttony, all of the things that have torn our planet apart all have to do with human beings trying to prove that they're first, at least in the eyes, if nothing else, than their family. And how many, you know why a person hits a dog? Because the dog won't put them first. You can look at every act of cruelty, and in it you will see a man or a woman who has decided that this person doesn't accept my authority, my position of being first, and therefore I must put them in their place. This is the nature of horrible, horrible things. Now the question is, if at the root of this terrible problem that we, the pain of it, this fear, if its root is in the pretense, in trying always to prove myself. Let's just, do you understand that? Pretending and trying to prove ourselves is one thing. Take a deep breath. I don't want to lose you here. I want so badly for you to hear what I'm saying this morning. Can you see that pretending and trying to prove are very much in relationship with one another? That would I need to prove anything if I wasn't pretending at it? I wouldn't, would I? So me always wanting to prove myself in whatever it may be is an indicator that I'm a pretender. Yes or no? Absolutely. So with this in mind, is there a way out? Meaning, what does one do if I'm not first? And if I can see, no matter how dimly, nothing I'm going to do to myself, by myself, for myself, or with others is going to change that, what do I do? Now, here comes some surprises. Hope you're ready for them. I'm going to read to you something from Luke. And you're going to hear some things that you've never heard before in your life. And then we're going to examine its meaning relative to this constant pain of fear born of trying to prove that one who pretends can be real. This is chapter 4. Now, if you have a reaction, and some people do, to Scripture or reading from the Bible, I want you to try to put it aside as best you can, because the things that are spoken of in the Bible, in any true sacred testament, are the expression of principles that have been given a body by a human mind. The mind that embodies the principle, that gives it form, must, by the very fact that it itself can only work with form, must always bring down this formless, eternal truth into something that has constitution, something that can get one's mind around it. Because it's so difficult to talk about truth and at the same time get one's mind around it, yet not compromise it, this is where people lose the possibility of ever finding anything beautiful. Because in the Scripture that I'm going to read to you, as we examine the interior, hidden meaning of it, you'll see that not only don't people understand it, but most of us don't even take time to try to understand it. So let me go through this, chapter 4. And Christ, being full of the Holy Ghost, returned from Jordan and was led by the Spirit into the wilderness. This was just after, for those of you who are Christian, this is just after his encounter with John the Baptist. Being 40 days tempted of the devil, and in those days he did eat nothing. And when they were ended, he afterward hungered. He went out into the desert for 40 days. 40, by the way, is the number of a complete cycle in the old language. And the devil said unto him, If thou be the Son of God, command this stone that it be made of bread. And Jesus answered him, saying, It is written that man shall not live by bread alone, but by every word of God. I'm going to read this, then I'm going to go back and explain these. And then the devil, taking him up into a high mountain, showed him all the kingdoms of the world in a moment of time. And the devil said to him, All this power I will give thee, and the glory of them, for it is delivered unto me. Meaning the devil was saying that everything you see here, all the kingdoms, all the people in them, are mine. They're delivered unto me. And to whomsoever I will give it. So he was saying that all that you see belongs to me, and I can give it to whoever I want to. And Christ said to him, Get thee behind me, Satan, for it is written, Thou shalt worship the Lord thy God and serve only him. And then the devil brought Christ to Jerusalem and set him on a pinnacle of the temple and said to him, if you're the Son of God, cast yourself down from hence. For it is written, the devil went on, and he's now quoting the Old Testament, he shall give his angels charge over thee to keep thee. And in their hands they shall bear thee up, lest any time thou shalt dash a foot against a stone. And Jesus said to him, it is said, thou shalt not tempt the Lord thy God. And when the devil had ended all the temptation, he departed from him for a season. Now, what does all that mean? What in the heck is this talking about? Was there some fellow with horns, you know, and a tail appear in the desert and talk to this great being called Christ? What was all of this to mean? And what, and to whom does it have meaning? If I was to ask you what meaning it has, I dare say, without judging you, that you don't have a clue other than what you were taught to say. This is not why we're here. We're not here to taught what we're to, what's been said. We're here to see if there's truth. Listen, not in Scripture, but in the book of life that is in us, that this Scripture then became a manifestation of. And there's a difference between the book of life being read in a human being's heart versus reading from a book and then taking it to heart and hating others because they don't agree with you about it. So let's look at this. The first thing the devil said was, if thou be the Son of God, command this stone that it be made of bread. And Christ answered him, that man shall not live by bread alone, but by every word of God. What does that mean, that man shall not live by bread alone, but by every word of God? Christ was saying here, look, I know that I will be sustained by a different order of relationship through in which I do not have to prove myself by providing for my own needs. He said, devil said, turn this stone into bread. And Christ said, look, I don't have to turn this stone into bread. I don't have to prove one thing to you. Because I know that I will be and always have been given a nourishment that doesn't require me proving to anyone that I have it. So there's the first thing. He does not have to prove himself by providing for himself what he needs. Isn't that? See, I better slow down a little bit. I have to go slow here. See, the devil challenges thought, this mind challenges on one level. If you're so and so and so, then go ahead and command that this stone be made into bread. Christ didn't answer him on the same level as the challenge. The light never answers the darkness in the same way. Instead of saying, well, look, I could do that if I wanted to. Or I'm not hungry for bread at the moment. No, please, see, this is the problem. Everything's unexamined with you. He says, command this stone be made of bread. And what Christ said to him was, look, it's man doesn't live by bread alone, but by the word of God. What on earth does that mean? It means in that instant, I'm not answering what you're asking me. I'm telling you, I don't have to prove myself to myself that my needs, that I have to supply myself with my own needs. We are always supplying ourselves with our own needs. We are always commanding that the stone be made into bread, and the bread is never the bread when we've commanded it. Do you understand? You command the situation. You try to control the circumstance so that instead of the stone, you've got what you want. Because you can prove to yourself that you are what you do, and you command the stone be made into bread. And it doesn't turn into bread. It turns into fool's bread. It turns into food with no substance, because no sooner do you consume it than you have to command another stone. How many of you understand that idea? The next part. And then the devil took him up on a high mountain and showed him all the kingdoms. Said, if you'll just worship me, I'm going to give you everything that you see, because it all belongs to me. Now, what does that refer to? In this instance, the devil, this fallen nature, this divided nature, he was saying, look, here is what will happen in a time to come. If you will do this, I will do that. He was saying that there would be a moment when, if you will fall down and worship me, that I will give you all that I have. Now, here's the key here. He's saying, in this instance, he's saying the light should serve darkness. And what did Christ say? essentially, get thee behind me. What is get thee behind? You're out of order. You have the wrong order. He didn't answer the order that nature presented to him. He didn't answer it at the level. If the devil says, here, I'm going to give you all this stuff. You say, well, that's I don't really want it today. I don't think you can.
You're listening to Letting Go with Guy Finley. For more information about Guy's life-empowering ideas, visit GuyFinley.com. We'll be back in a moment.
Love, the brightest and most powerful force in the universe. Love melts stress and cancels resentment. It gives birth to kindness and is the fuel of success. Love is at the heart of every great relationship and is the true essence of lasting peace. In his new book, Apprentice of the Heart, best-selling author Guy Finley explores lessons in life only love can teach. This breakthrough book contains the tools you need to strengthen and deepen all of your relationships with family, friends, coworkers, and with the present moment itself. Apprentice of the Heart, available now at GuyFinley.com and fine bookstores everywhere. Joseph Polansky of Diamond Fire magazine writes, "The reader is lifted up to a whole new realm, a rarefied region of the soul." To order your copy of Guy Finley's Apprentice of the Heart, visit GuyFinley.com. That's GuyFinley.com. The relationship your heart longs for already exists.
Welcome back to Letting Go with best-selling author Guy Finley.
No answer connected to the challenge. The answer was always above the challenge. And in this instance, it was, get out of here. Get behind me. You're out of order. Light is first, not darkness. Light doesn't worship darkness. Darkness sits at the foot of light. And then he went on to say, because in essence, we're to give ourselves not to a kingdom to come, but a kingdom that exists now. And I'm to serve only that life that is his when it is expressed now. See, he says, get thee behind me. Get thee behind me, Satan. Thou shalt worship thy Lord thy God, and only him shalt thou serve. Only him shall I serve, not you. So the order of things is reversed, meaning, take it home now personally, inside of ourselves, we are always saying to ourselves, if we only do this, then we will have the kingdom. We will have what we need. If we blame someone, if we make a plan, if we change something, if we get after whatever it is, then all that will be delivered unto us. And at that point where we follow that, we serve the darkness. The light serves darkness. Darkness is not supposed to be served by light. And Christ says instead, thou shalt worship thy Lord thy God, and him only shall you serve. And that means that we are to adore, because worship means to adore. And to adore is to give oneself to what is now, not to what will be. Because when you give yourself to what will be, you are giving yourself over to the pretender who promises there will be a time when you will have the things that you think you don't. Can you understand that idea? Then, next part. And he brought him to Jerusalem and put him on the pinnacle of a temple and says, if you're the Son of God, cast yourself down from here, for it's written that God shall give him angels charge over you and keep you, and in your hands they'll bear you up, and nothing bad is going to happen. And this is really interesting, because can you imagine... Because we know that in this instance, if we've done our own work, we know the truth of this from ourselves. But if you're only scripturally oriented, Christ knew what was going to happen to him. Imagine, here's the devil not only mocking Christ, but Christ knowing that there was going to come a time when he was going to have to give up his life altogether, and that he couldn't call on the angels even then to help him. Here's Satan throwing it in his face. Here is this nature that begins to have a sense, hopefully, that one must give up one's life. And here comes a thought, and it says, look, all you have to do is just, it's written, you're going to be taken care of, no problems. Just call on them, throw yourself off. And here's what was really going on behind that, because this is the most extraordinary part. The devil is saying to him, you do this. And then... And then Christ says, thou shalt not tempt thy Lord thy God. Thou shalt not tempt thy Lord thy God. Have you ever thought about that? What the heck does thou shalt not tempt thy Lord thy God mean? Can you tempt God? It's Christ. Christ says you shall not tempt God. Well, how do you tempt God? But this was the answer that he gave to this thought, this dark thought nature. Thou shalt not tempt thy Lord thy God. Because here's at the root of it. The devil was saying to Christ, make God prove himself to you. Isn't that what he's saying? If you're this, then just jump off here because it's written nothing's going to happen to you. How many of you understand that? It's written. It's done. Nothing can happen to you. Prove it. Prove God by jumping. Christ says, thou shalt not tempt the Lord thy God. Now here's what the interior meaning of this. Now listen closely. I'll repeat it twice. Then we're going to go into it. I will not be tempted into setting myself apart from God's life in order to prove it. I will not be tempted into setting myself apart from God's life in order to prove it. Because don't you see that if he was to do that, if he said, okay, no problem, that he has to set himself apart from the very principle that God will take care of him, that God is his care. If he tries to prove it, then that's what it means to tempt God. Every time a human being sets himself apart from the life of truth, every time a person is divided, they are setting themselves apart from life in order to prove the life they have set themselves apart from. Is anybody getting an inkling here? Why do I have to set myself apart from life for any reason at all? And aren't I always setting myself apart from life every time I talk about myself? Every time I pretend to be something, haven't I instantly set myself apart from a world in which I want to be seen in one way and fear that I'm not? Isn't that true? Can't you see it? So here is this the root of this temptation. In fact, all of this, you know, the devil originally was called the great deceiver. And that's obviously inside of a human being, there is something that is forever deceiving the human being, because if he wasn't being deceived, he wouldn't set himself apart from life in order to prove life. And that's what thought does. Every time that you think about yourself, every time you think about another human being, every time that you put yourself out there and demand attention, whatever it is, that you, every time you cry to yourself, I'm asking you to see that in that moment, there is something inside of you that has set you out apart from life, that blames life for your crying, and that proves to you that you are first, and that life somehow has put you second where you shouldn't be. All understood so far? Because we have to go on now. All right. Now, take a deep breath because we have the next section to go into here. Here we have a really deep idea. Is that I have a fear of something, and you can name what it is. He doesn't love me, she won't. They don't understand me. No one gets what I'm talking about. Life didn't bring me what it should, and I don't think it's going to. And that there's this a kind of constant undertone, a dark undertone of fear in a person's life. And the presence of the fear in the person's life is always urging that person, to go ahead and somehow change the conditions and to prove that who they are is who they have taken themselves to be. It's endless. Because the more that one tries to prove themselves, which they can only do by pretending, the more they fear. And the more they fear, the more they think they have to prove themselves. Look, how many of you know that when you get in an argument, it starts at a low level and winds up in an explosion? That is the escalation of pretense. It's the escalation of pretense. Because you're challenging what I say I am and what is true. And the more you challenge it, the more I fear. The more I fear, the more I try to prove. The more I prove, I have to pretend. The more I pretend, the more I fear. Do you see what we're doing here? Do you see what truth is doing? Beautiful, 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 beautiful truth. Bringing this light in and down into us. Setting it up so that the next time you start to feel sorry for yourself or you start to get angry at somebody and you see it all taking place, you'll have a chance to say, wait a minute, who's first here? What's first? Is it, am I accomplishing really anything here, or am I only aching for all of my attempts to prove myself through negative states? Imagine a person proving himself through negative states. And can a person take a negative state as something positive unless that person is so wrapped up in pretending to be what they're not that all they have is the negative state to look to prove themselves? Imagine such a condition. That's when the darkness becomes so great that the light has no place in it at all, and then a human being is finished on this planet. So, what do we do? And when I say that, if you've understood what we've been talking about, it transcends the ability to put into a clever expression what all of this leads to in a person. But it does point to something that's critical for us to understand, because Christ was saying, and we are saying as we work, okay, I understand a certain fundamental principle now, that there is something in me that has deceived me. And I have fallen fully for the idea that I somehow am special. That somehow I am so unique in the world that all should recognize my uniqueness. And what is it that gives me my sense of uniqueness other than how much I hurt? The suffering that I feel, the anger, the fear. I'm so special because of how much I suffer. And a person who thinks they're special because they suffer has yet to understand that the only thing that their suffering is doing isn't proving that they're special, but secretly stealing from the possibility of recognizing that is this part of themselves that has slipped in there and said, you're first. Don't let anybody tell you anything different than that. You're the only one. And I want you to know you're not. I want you to know that there is a real first. And we're going to call it, for the purpose of the talk, we're going to call this the first presence. The first presence. Now, what is the first presence? That's what we're going to look at. Look around. Boy, what a day to do it, too. Snow on the trees, green grass under the white snow. Anything that you look at, of course, I can't turn around and look out the window and talk at the same time, can I? Because then I disappear from the microphone. Everything, every object that you look at, yes or no, when you look at it, can you see that each and every object has a presence to it? Now, don't think. I don't want you to think. When you look at a tree that's dressed in white, and I was thinking this morning, even God in His glory, nature in its beauty, even dresses up things that have died and makes them beautiful. I was looking at this dead tree and it was dressed in a white gown this morning, and it was so pristine and new. Everything that you look at, every object, if you really give your attention to it, gives you in the moment of your attention to it a taste of its presence. There is nothing that exists, nothing created that exists without presence. Even a stone, if you were ever to see one, has presence. And each and every one of the creations that has presence has a unique presence. No two stones have the same presence. No blade of grass has the same presence as another blade of grass. How God does things like this, I don't know. Everything has a presence. And when you give your attention to it, you are very, if you can be, you can see, there's a presence. That's when we talk about looking in nature or a night sky, a star, a planet or the moon, or what you, even a person's face, a dog. When you look at that, what captures you mostly, although from time to time it becomes denigrated, a person starts to become fascinated with their remembrance of what that image is, as opposed to the actual participation in the presence of it. When you do, there's a presence there, and you get to drink the presence. Your life is made, if you will, a little more, and we'll cover that word in a moment, by your relationship to what you are present to. And I looked up in the dictionary the word present, and the word present means to be in the presence of another. To be present is to be in the presence of another. In the presence of another. So, first, the idea that each thing and all things have a presence. Now, how are we related to the presence of whatever it is that we give our attention to? We know that there's a sharing, don't we? We are related to the presence of whatever our attention goes to through our awareness of it. It is our awareness of that tree covered with that white silky snow that lets us have a taste of the presence of that beauty, of the form, of the life itself. And each time that we give our attention to something and have for a moment awareness of it, clearly of it, we have in the same moment, through awareness of the presence in us, the presence that we are aware of. This was a key idea. In the moment that my awareness goes to the presence of something, it is through that awareness that I share in the presence. So the fact is that my awareness of the presence of something is the awareness of the presence of that in me. It is not the awareness of the presence of the thing out there. Otherwise, I wouldn't be in relationship with it. It would still be apart from me. So in that split second where my awareness falls into the presence of something, because I am present to it, in that same split second, lo and behold, the presence of that which I am aware of gives me awareness of its presence in me. Can you understand this? Oh, I hope you do. If you don't, you get this tape and listen to it 1,000 times. Now, if that's true, and all of these things are that we're describing are in scale. Now we have to do something and look at something. Take a deep breath. You need more oxygen to your brain, I can tell. There is what we're going to call the experience of awareness. Now the experience of awareness is not complicated. All animals have it. A dog walks out on the street and he has an experience generated by his awareness. And his awareness isn't awareness of the type in which he's aware of himself, but he has through his senses the awareness of objects outside of himself. He does not participate in the presence of what he sees, but he responds to the presence through what his senses dictate due to his instincts. This is rudimentary awareness. This is awareness that all creatures in common share on this planet. That I'm related to the objects and the things around me and the meaning of them through a rudimentary awareness. The rudimentary awareness establishes the parameters of the relationship, but it does not allow me to participate in that which that is aware of. That is what we're calling for this talk, experience of awareness. And then there is the order that we're talking about now, which is awareness of experiencing. Awareness of experiencing. Because, what did we say? Here I am, and when I see the tree, when I'm present to it, when I give my awareness to it, the presence of that which I hold in my mind is not simply out there, but has been revealed as being a part of myself through my awareness. How many of you understand this a little bit? We're running out of time pretty quickly. Now, it's kind of key to get the idea, because most of us walk through our lives in a complete dream, completely asleep. Totally asleep, just like an animal, relating not only to the world around us, but relating to our own thoughts that we are having the experience of. We don't experience the person, we don't experience the room, we experience what our mind tells us the person is and what the room means to us in that moment through a rudimentary kind of sensory awareness that merely orients us to everything around us according to what we hope to get from it or fear of it. So that there's this constant juggling and a never-ending fear, because I wouldn't be trying to take something from you. I wouldn't be trying to get something from you or ask you to prove or validate me unless I was a pretender, unless I was a fake. I wouldn't be doing it. Now, experiencing being aware means that in that moment where I'm with you, I have a new first. I have a new first. My new first is the presence of the moment. My new first is the presence of the moment. You've all heard the idea of practicing the presence of God, yes? See, what does that mean? I'm talking to you about it. Practicing the first presence. Practicing the first presence. What's the second presence? We've been talking about it. What's the second presence? The second presence is me thinking about myself in the moment. And the second presence is loaded with pretense because it's the only way it can exist. It can only exist by thinking about itself. That's the second presence. That's what we've been talking about. Now we're saying, okay, I'm beginning to get my mind around it a little bit. I can see it when I'm afraid, when I want the attention. You name what it is that goes on in such moments. Ah, wait a second. The experience of this awareness of this moment shows me something in me is afraid, something in me is agitated, something in me is angry. And if those states exist, it is the proof of this second presence, of the pretender, of the deceiver. And I'm in its hands, but didn't know I was in its hands because I was speaking for it. I was doing its thinking and giving myself to its thoughts, but no more. Instead, I drop the second presence and I adopt the first presence. Meaning, first presence becomes what's critical to me. And what's the first presence? I'm here. I am aware of the whole of the moment, and it is my first preference. Why? Because in that first presence that I'm talking about, listen, when one has what we're calling the awareness of experiencing, is there anything outside of the awareness of experiencing this moment? If I actually am aware, if I actually am there, there's not a thought that goes through that isn't part of that awareness. It's part of the experiencing. There isn't a facial, there's nothing about the moment that isn't contained in that, nothing, which means there's nothing and no one outside of it to prove a thing. And not only that, but I can find out for myself what Christ was talking about in these three temptations, which is, I don't have to prove a thing. What is there for me to prove here? My Father's taken care of it all. Life, capital L, God, He's got the whole thing handled. But in order for me to have it all handled through Him, I have to be in the first presence where His powers have seen to everything completely. And all temptation across the board, and don't make it a negative word, make it a word that has to do with a mind that is divided against itself without knowing it. All temptation is me trying to provide for myself, period. Meaning, trying to prove that I am what I pretend to be. You must see for yourself the fact of what I'm saying. You sit there and you're talking, you're out with people, you're having a conversation, whatever, all the time, always going on, and begin to notice little things. These aren't big things I'm talking about. Simply to gradually start looking and see, you know, what's first right now? Right now, while I'm talking to you, for instance, what's first? Am I aware of the first presence? Meaning, am I aware of this moment as it is, with all of the things that are moving through me as well? Or am I lost in that cavern of self-consideration? Am I on center stage in my own mind? Am I the only one I've been thinking of? Do you see? And if you've understood at all what I'm talking about, then if I'm the only one I've been thinking of, what kind of fool am I? What kind of man, what kind of woman am I? What is my nature in such a moment where all there is on my mind is resolving what I'm feeling or trying to get rid of a fear of some kind? What am I in that moment? And if you look and see relative to what we've been talking about, you will see that all there is there at such a moment is someone who is trying to prove to himself that he's real. Something that is trying to prove to itself that it's real. It's not a one. It's not a someone. Although, interestingly enough, since every human being is filled with that same nature, one could say it is one nature dedicated to the proposition that if it can pretend long enough, it will eventually prove itself to be real. But we're learning that there's great pain in pretending. carrying ourselves around and having attitudes and stressing our opinions and trying to prove to ourselves that we're real, because we can talk with at endless length about what happened to us yesterday. Would you like a great exercise to help you practice the first presence? Never talk about your past. Do you know that if people on this planet suddenly stopped talking about their past, the world would go silent? It would. And I guess what I'm asking you to see is, what is that life that only exists as long as it can refer to something that was? What is that life? Is that life, or is it an echo, a memory? See, it's not life, it is the dead. And the extraordinary thing is that the tempter, the temptation inside of us, unseen but active endlessly, is to continually try to give birth to ourselves again. And it fails. It's a horror, actually. In case you haven't noticed that, have you noticed that? That the more an individual spends his or her time trying to give birth to themselves through reliving whatever it is they're reliving, the uglier the human being becomes? See, so all of this beautiful evidence about a kind of temptation that goes on day in and day out, because it's built right into the fabric of a divided mind. A divided mind means a mind whose thought first generates an image and then has to substantiate the image by thinking about it again. This is the essence of what a divided mind is. This is the essence of temptation, to prove that which doesn't exist exists by suffering over its continual disappearance. So, with only a few minutes left, we're going to talk about a quick exercise so that we have a way in which it's possible to work at doing what we've been talking about. We've been talking about practicing the first presence. Do it right now. Come fully aware of all that you're experiencing, and that includes your thoughts and feelings, the tension in your body if you have it. Practicing the first presence. In the moment of practicing the first presence, you have, if you've done it properly, touched the hem of love. Because God is love. And when I say you've touched the hem of love, what I mean is, in the moment that you are practicing the first presence, that you are working at having this awareness of experiencing the moment, the whole is present to you. And it is made whole in you by the awareness of the presence. Last thought. It's a deep one. Take a deep breath. Last thought. If my awareness of the presence of something gives me the understanding that that which I am aware of, its presence is in me, then what happens when a man or a woman remembers the presence of God? The presence of the whole moment. Not as a word and not as a thought and an exercise, but as an actual willingness to bring oneself into that first presence. And because one brings oneself into the first presence, lo and behold, there is no longer difference between their awareness of the presence and the presence they are aware of. In such a moment, there is no distinction between the presence that they are aware of and the awareness of that presence. In such moments, all pretense disappears because all separation falls away. The need to prove yourself simply evaporates because in that moment you are where you are intended to be as the son or daughter of the true King, of true life with a capital L. And it's all spread out in front of you. That's the extraordinary thing about truth. There's never been a moment in our lives, not one of us, where the whole thing hasn't been right in front of us, but we've been unable to see it because our eyes have been on ourselves, directed by the deceiver who would have us believe that it's possible to prove that we are first. We are not first. All attempts to prove ourselves as being such is the root of pain and fear. When we start to get it at last, start to wake up a little bit, and rather than wanting, I want experience, the experience of myself having been in a room where someone didn't trust me or someone said something that hurt me. I want the experience because I want to prove that they're wrong and I want to prove I'm right, and you kill yourself. Versus living. not only being alive, but because your awareness of the presence of the first presence is the same as that presence in you, God, truth, Christ, the light, now lives in you because you have put that first.
Hello, I'm Desi Arnaz Jr. You've been listening to Letting Go with best-selling author Guy Finley. To learn more about Guy Finley and his nonprofit Life of Learning Foundation, visit GuyFinley.com, where you'll find a host of free, life-changing information. Thanks for joining us today.